Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, all my dear friends. This is your spokesman with the plan, Clarence Cloverleaf, welcoming you to Cloverleaf Radio on the JIA Network. You can listen to our shows on close to 20 different streaming platforms, including Anchor, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Radio Public, and YouTube, to name a few. I've helped compile a list of our best guests since 2008, and those interviews have been scattered about the cloud, as they say. Something I thought we only received rain from. Go figure. So, go find yourself a good one, and you can listen 24/7, 365, to guests from all genres of entertainment. You'll never know who could show up. Check out www.jianetwork.com. And now, on to the main event with your host, the host with the most...
Hi, everybody. This is Larry Kenny. You know me best for voicing Lion-O on Thundercats and as the voices of Count Chocula and Sonny the Cuckoo Puffs Bird for Cocoa Puffs. And you're listening to Cloverleaf Radio, hosted by the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon. And
alrighty, we are back for another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio. I am the host of the most and the Frostbite currently, Jimmy Falcon, and we are joined today by my old friend, Dark History and Horror Con founder, author, man of a thousand faces and facets, Brian Ward.
Great intro. Thank you, sir.
How's things been, brother?
Oh, they've been good. They've been good. Getting ramped up a little bit. I tend not to get stressed or anxious about anything, but yet I'm excited that it's getting close.
Well, I can understand how you could have a lot of anxiety and stress leading up to this because, being that it's a small-town thing, you're a small-town guy, you may not necessarily have the outlets that the larger Chicago and L.A. and Tampa, so to say, and the Comic-Cons have. So I can understand, being your own person with a small group of people, how frustrating it could be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a while in the making trying to get Champaign Urbana to recognize what's going on. I think we've picked up a lot of traction this year. Everybody's always said they thought it was cool and they liked the idea, but then getting people on board and actually showing up and following through with things has been a little bit of a chore here in Champaign Urbana. I guess a lot of people feel like there's plenty of options. They don't need me, but we're going to prove them wrong.
Well, I, being that I've always found some sort of psychological fascination with serial killers, we've had these conversations numerous times, I think that a place to learn more about murderers and killers and gangsters and, so on and so forth, there needs to be more of those kind of conventions and, outlets for people to learn. That we're all just not like, we don't just obsess and love serial killers and, we're just, oh my God, John Wayne Gacy's so awesome. It's more like, trying to learn, I guess no one will ever quite know, but trying to learn what makes people like that tick and what makes someone take a life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's always been the stigma that we've kind of fought against is everybody, oh, you're glorifying these people and what they did. That's never been it at all. And here again, like you said, we've had conversations, but if anybody hasn't heard my take on that is basically these people would be nothing without the victims that they took. So the victims deserve more recognition than the actual killers do. Unfortunately, I'd say probably since the age of journalism, the splashy, macabre, flashy stuff is what gets the attention. So the guys that are doing these things have always gotten the attention going back to the, beginning of time, most likely. So it's unfortunate that that's just the way we as humans have always liked to hear our news, is all the bloody, gory details and the victims get lost in the shuffle. We try not to do that at all. And I'll use that as a perfect segue to say that I'm actually bringing a victim this year, Waco survivor David Thibodeau. I don't think he'd classify himself as a victim, but he was definitely in the middle of one of the more horrific stories of the 90s, if not ever in our country. And,
right.
You know, you don't hear from those guys because that's just the media narrative at the time was we had to demonize them. So Dave is going to kind of give us a little bit more of what actually factually happened rather than what the slant was back in the 90s.
Yeah, he told me he's really looking forward to appearing and giving his speech. Said he hasn't given a talk in many years. And I think that, you know, learning more about things like Waco or Jonestown, you know, these things, whether we want to admit or not, they're a part of our conscience. They're a part of, you know, history and people's everyday conversation. So whether you try to ignore these things or not, it's still being brought up and being willing to learn more and not just justify someone's being a weirdo. It's kind of
right.
Exactly.
And I mean, I just got off the phone with David right before this, as a matter of fact, and we were talking. I did a radio interview with Parkland College Radio here a couple weeks ago, and that's all student run. So the kid had heard of Waco, but he just heard the name. He didn't really know what had gone into it.
Right.
And I told him when he started to research that, he needed to look back at Ruby Ridge because that was ultimately led to Waco, which ultimately led to Oklahoma City. That's something a lot of people don't know. A lot of people talk about Oklahoma City and how tragic it was, and we understand that. But they don't realize the roots of it come from those two previous incidents. So you need to kind of know these things. And whether you like the idea of us bringing up the dark stuff or not, if you don't see – how things got there, then you know, it's like the saying goes, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. It happens anyway. I mean, people like you and I that do know the history, we're not big and powerful enough to stop some of these things that we certainly see coming around again. But when they do, we could say, well, yeah, we've been telling you guys, we knew this was going to happen. You can just see, look at these instances.
And see, you know, you made a great point there. It's to never forget your history or you're doomed to repeat it. I think people are, you know, need to be learning that now more than ever, especially ripping out these Confederate statues. Now, I'm not saying there needs to be, you know, this undefined love and glory for the Southern and the Civil War in the past, but you have to, you know, put something next to that that represents today. Put a young black man, you know, getting his diploma, or, you know, put something that shows we've come farther and we're not going backward.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yeah, that's an argument that I don't know. I've got friends and associates on both sides of the whole tearing down the Confederate memorials side of the argument. And I have to confess, I sound very much like a politician when it comes to that because I can see both sides. I, being a history guy and wanting to preserve things, here again, that comes down to, are we glorifying them? Are we saying, hey,
right,
this is a monument to the great stuff they did, which admittedly wasn't great? Or are we just, you know, you got to look at that time and this is what it meant. And that they are large parts of history. So how do we choose to remember that now with the knowledge we have now? And how much can we color with our hindsight that, you know, that they didn't have then, and that's a tough argument.
Yeah, I can understand, you know, if you're a young black man who's successful and you walk past his statue and see it, your emotions are going to be different than mine or yours, per se.
For sure.
Because, you know, all that with the Jim Crow and with slavery being in that person's family history, it's definitely going to have a different effect. But I still think maybe if they could see you know, a current statue of someone, you know, getting past that maybe that might help. But like you said, there's it's one of those political debates that people could go on about for days.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you're a little younger than I am, but I think you probably are around when Hootie and the Blowfish blew up big. They're from South Carolina, and like they said, you know, the South Carolina, the Capitol building, that flag's flying. Yeah, I get the history of South Carolina. I mean, shit, they started the Civil War. But at this day and time, do you maybe revisit that and redo your state flag? Because, yeah, are you – I can see where it's waving in the face of all the young black men, even older generations. It's kind of just in your face. So I certainly get that. And yeah,
oh,
it's one of those things.
That is very true. And one thing I don't think we talked about the last time, you know, well, we brought it up, but I don't know if maybe you were still in the works with it, was the book you did with Eric Verner, Jeffrey Dahmer, Confessions of the Milwaukee Cannibal.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you decide to get into authoring a book? Because it's not easy, and it definitely takes a lot of knowledge on what to do one particular person instead of just a menagerie of killers. So why do the book? Why Jeffrey Dahmer?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, doing a menagerie would probably have been more up my alley just because, as we've talked before and people may or may not know about me, this whole thing, I mean, it always started with reading and my own interest in it, and then it graduated to me going to locations where crimes took place and kind of documenting what happened there and writing up
right.
little narratives and putting them on my original Facebook page. And people have always, as they've gotten to know me, why don't you write a book about this stuff, man? Why don't you write a book? And I've been hearing it for years. I just so happened to have a chance encounter with a Milwaukee PD sergeant when I was working at a police department. And I went ahead and bit the bullet and asked him, since as soon as I found out he was from Milwaukee, he was on the police force, and found out how long he'd been, I asked the Dahmer question, and he told me a story, and we became friendly. He invited me up to tour Milwaukee PD with him and on shift one day, so we went up there and pretty much spent the entire day at the Milwaukee police headquarters, and at the end of it, he gave me, you know, the entire Dahmer confession, both a hard copy on paper and a PDF on a disc. And then after that, we met for drinks and a bite to eat at Shaker's Cigar Bar with Dennis Murphy, who was the lead investigator on Jeffrey Dahmer. He's since retired, and he had been retired at that point, but the lieutenant still knew him and told him I was in town and what I wanted to do. So I got to talk with Dennis Murphy for about an hour, and all that experience just kind of came together. Eric Verner was at one of my shows, and I had to give him a ride back at that time. I took him back over to Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is about a 4-4.5 hour drive from us, and we talked the entire time, and I told him that I had that confession, and he's like, well, we should really think about turning that into a book. It took about 3 or 4 years, but finally made it happen this last year, and here we are now with the book out and co-authored it. I wrote the beginning part. Eric did most of the background research, but I just relayed what I learned from Dennis and how the story affected me. I mean, I remember when it broke. It was July of 1991. I think I graduated high school in May of 91. There was a movie out that summer, or it was supposed to come out, called Body Parts with Jeff Fahey, and I remember them having to push back the release of the movie because it was supposed to come out right at the time of the Dahmer discovery, and they're like, yeah, we, that's not going to look good publicity, or, you know, a movie called Body Parts coming out after we found this. So it was just one of those things that it just happened that I was able to meet some key players in the Dahmer thing, so that became the first book.
Now, what I'm curious, what Dennis Murphy had to say about, you know, Dahmer in short terms, of course, not giving too much away, but
right.
Just dealing with someone of that matter.
It surprised me. I mean, I know Milwaukee's a big city, and I shouldn't have been surprised that he'd obviously not seen anything on that scale, but he told me in that meeting, and I don't remember the exact number, but at that point, I think he had interviewed over 500 people that had been brought in on murder charges. So he had dealt with murderers before, obviously not serial killers. But the thing, I think the reason Dennis and I got along as well as we did was, as he was talking, he viewed things the same way I do. He knew his job was to get these confessions and to get enough to prosecute and get a conviction for this man, but also compassionate enough to come at it with, all right, how did we get to this point? And it's very interesting if you have a chance to pick up the book or if you have any other means of getting the confession. I mean, if you read it from beginning to end, you will see very quickly that each paper begins with whatever the name of the lockup was, message sent to our supervisor that Dahmer wants to speak with Murphy and Kennedy, who was Murphy's partner, wants to speak with Detectives Murphy and Kennedy, da-da-da-da-da. And he's asking 2-3 times a day, every day. And Dennis told me, Jeff just wanted to talk. He never had anybody to talk to. Not right. Just about these, obviously, the things. If he would have had somebody to talk to, would he have not done the crimes he did? I don't know about that. Nobody does. But once he felt like these guys were listening and were not shooting him down with condemning looks or just being rude and mean, but actually trying to understand and get the info from him, he wanted to talk to him every minute of every day if he could. He even, in a number of the papers, you'll see them asking, has your lawyer approved this? You know, you're supposed to go through your lawyer to tell him you want to talk to us. And he, at numerous points throughout, Dahmer's like, no, that's fine. I didn't contact him. I don't need to. I just want to talk to you guys. I don't want to, you know, we don't need to go through all the hoops, just come over. So it got to the point where these were his only friends, and for lack of a better term, only friends. So he just opened up everything to them because that's something he always needed.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the old saying goes, you can catch more flies with honey than vinegar. Even someone like Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy, Ted Kaczynski, anybody, you know, who could do something so horrific to take another life or to rape someone, still has a human being, even if it's a minuscule part of them down in there somewhere. And a lot of people, like you said, just want somebody to talk to.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that's what it boiled down to. And I mean, Dennis told me, it's in the book. It's not given a whole lot away, but Dennis told me he went to visit him just a couple weeks before Dahmer was killed in prison. And he had seen a tremendous change in him. He'd always presented himself just very nonchalant, like you and I are. Not, you know, a lot of people are like, yeah, he was gay, but he wasn't. I don't want to offend anybody. I don't think it is, but he wasn't over the top and flamboyant and things like that. He was just a regular guy. Well, Dennis told me on that last visit, he had found out that Jeff had requested to go to general population, and he knew that that wasn't going to end well. And he said when Jeff came walking in, he said Jeff kind of was walking kind of swishy and gave a really feminine type of handshake and was talking in a simpering type of voice. Hey, Dennis. And he was like, and this just wasn't Jeff. So I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, and he just kind of snapped out of it. And hey, I'm going to Gen Pop. And he's like, you know what that means, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure, and I'm ready for it. So he went into the whole thing of there's nothing worth living for, basically, and might as well make it, you know, if he was going to go in, he was going to go in all in and try to get it happen as soon as possible, it seems like.
Yeah, especially given the severity of his crimes and just wanting to go to Gen Pop. He would have had to have known that someone was going to come up and beat him to death. I mean, it was going to happen. He was despised by, you know, people worldwide once these things were nationalized and put into the media. So, yeah, I would say that in a messed up way, he was ready to just get done with it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's what Dennis said. He's exactly. He's like, I got what he was saying. He knew that I understood that that's what he was looking to do. Not only just going to Gen Pop, but if he's going to go to Gen Pop, he's going to be over the top flamboyant to agitate and get it done as soon as can. So, and that, I think, for people like you and I, that speaks volumes to, you know, how complex and how tortured and twisted the guy was.
Oh, absolutely. And I guess I was curious. Of course, we go to graveyards. We both have these pages. Yours has been to a lot more fun sites than I have. But I was curious, being that you visited John Dillinger's grave at the crash, the Buddy Holly crash site, Avery Cotto, all these places, what would you say was the most interesting and intriguing to you?
Ooh, wow. Ian, you should know better by now not to ask this many questions because I don't have a good answer. Oh, man.
You got to keep you on your toes.
I guess. They're, all right, here again, an extremely political answer. They are all fascinating and do something for me on a certain level in different ways. However, the gravity of the place, the gravity of the situation, and what happened there, I would have to say Columbine High School when I visited there.
Wow.
That occurred right at, I think it was within 4 days of my first marriage to the mother of my child. And so we were in our own little world, but that hit and splashed, and it was going on during our honeymoon. So I got to see papers from, we went down to Florida. So I got to see the Florida papers and the USA Today's and everything else. And it would just what it did to us as a society and culture to be wrapped up in it at the time. And then to have the opportunity years later after they remodeled. So it's not exactly the same, but as much research as I did into it to go there on a weekend when nobody was around and just kind of stand in the parking lot, look at the place, get the lay of the land. And I can almost, and this is where some people think I'm a little weird and I don't know about psychic abilities or not, but when you read research so much and then the place is right in front of you, you can almost see it. So I'm not saying I saw dead bodies, but I could almost visualize that's where Rachel Scott was. That's the window. That, forgive me for forgetting his name, but that's the window that the kid came from that everybody saw on the news. That I can see smoke. I can, you know, you can almost get wrapped up in it. So the gravity of the situation, I would say Columbine is right up there. I did go to Virginia Tech as well. I think the way Virginia Tech is laid out, since it's a big college campus, you lose a little bit of the effect, but there again, it's still there. So those two, I think, for the gravity of the situation, probably the biggest.
Wow. Yeah, I, talking back to Waco, that happened the year of probably some of my first memories. So I have none of that. I have few of Oklahoma City, but Columbine, I think a lot of people think maybe it was the first school shooting. It wasn't the first, but it was one that supercharged an era of school shootings.
For sure. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's unfortunate. I think about, Charles Whitman was someone else I was thinking about.
Oh, yeah.
At the University of Texas. But, these things, it amazes me that you can be so far gone in your own head to take it out on others.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, you know, that I get a lot being into this. And I can't remember if it was you or it was somebody else that's pretty close to me that went to one of the more recent conventions, went over to a gas station that was in front of the hotel and came back and said they heard people talking about, oh, those guys over there are all about serial killers and stuff. Okay, yeah, that was you. And they view us as maybe we're in the same boat, but that's where, you know, compassion and having a conscience come in is I can see how these people in their heads got to where they got to, but I can't make that step myself. And that's
right.
That's another story of the first wife. When I was reading all of Ted Bundy's confessions, and I made the mistake of telling her, I was like, I can see how he got there. And she completely mistook it like most people do. Oh, he can see how he got there. That means he can. That I should have worded it better. I can see the steps he took in his mind to get to where he got. When you read his words, you can see his thinking, okay, I've done this. I survived it. I kind of liked it. What's the next step? You can see those things. It doesn't mean you have them in you.
Right.
So, and that's what fascinates me. Like you said, we'll never probably know. And that's why I've always called this field endlessly fascinating, because I don't think we'll ever be able to know. But if you read somebody that Bundy was a master manipulator, who knows how much he really meant by some of the things he said. But at the end, when it seemed definite that he was going to die and he started confessing to things and maybe showing a little bit of who he was, he did say, all right, I did this. I mean, I remember the first person that he decided to jump was a lady outside of a bar. He hung out behind the dumpster clubbed her over the head. She started screaming, and he ran off. And he said, I puked. I couldn't believe that I did that. But then after that initial wave of revulsion wore off, I was like, hey, you know, that was actually kind of exciting. I need to do this to be better next time. I need them to do this so they don't scream. And so whatever that is in their psyche, yeah, I'm supposed to be repulsed by what I just did, and I am for half a second, but then that gives way to how much of a thrill I got out of it. And before too long, the thrill is completely there, and there's none of the repulsion anymore, and then, well, we know where it went from there.
I know it's kind of a bad thing to compare it to, but I guess in a sense you compare committing a murder to smoking your first cigarette. People tell you your whole life, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't
right.
do this, don't do this.
Yeah.
Then you do it once, you're like, oh my God, I'm going to puke, I'm never going to do this again. But then you're like, wait a minute, I kind of like the way that feels, I'm going to go buy a pack and then a carton and then you're fucked.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it's a bad comparison. Some people, if they just see it on the surface, they might think that, but as you went on to explain it, yeah, I mean, on a smaller scale that normal people can understand, I think that that's a perfect comparison because you need to see how minor that is. I mean, that seems like a minor thing. Oh, I'm going to go ahead and take a puff off a cigarette and I'm not going to feel great. But then I'm going to say, well, that was, you know, it wasn't so bad after I got a little head rush, whatever the case may be.
Right.
So you go on. People need to see this stuff in bite-sized, easy to digest pieces so they can get it. And then you can, and that's what I've always found with talking about this kind of history is so I get a lot of people that, I'm not a history fan, man. I don't like history. One recently who's really into music. And I was like, all right, what kind of music do you like? And she's like, all right, I like rock and roll. All right, rock and roll. You know who Led Zeppelin is? Yeah. I was like, all right, so you can see the influences in today's music from Led Zeppelin, right? She's like, yep. And I was like, okay, before Led Zeppelin could go out and do what they did, Elvis Presley comes along and Buddy Holly, and they break these barriers
right.
of what's supposed to sound right. And you know who they are. Yep. And I was like, all right, but we're talking history right now, and you don't even realize it. Oh, man, I never did see that. I was like, yeah, it's all in how you present it. So with you presenting, you know, the let's try a cigarette and let's try to murder and rape my first woman, you gotta approach people in a way that they can get it. And I think that was a perfect explanation.
Oh, I wish I could go on off some off on some professor tangent with big words and try to
right.
throw some kind of verbiage in there that sounds good. But that was kind of, you know, just thinking off the top of my head. That was kind of the comparison I had come up with. It's definitely completely different things and way off kilter, but I guess on a small scale, it does make sense.
Yeah, exactly.
But before we wrap up, of course, October 26th and 27th, I've said it so many times I can rattle it all off. 2019 at the City Center in Champaign, Illinois. 2019's Dark History and Horror Con at dhhcon.com. What can everybody expect? Of course, the famed, if someone has not attended one of these events, what can they expect to find and see and be able to purchase?
Some celebrities from Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV series. I've got a Waco survivor. I've got Scott Schwartz, who's a former professional wrestler that you may have seen in darn near any movie. A Leatherface from Texas Chainsaw 2. Wyatt Weed, a local guy that made good in movies. Like I said, James Leary, who was Clem. A lot of people recognize that series. And then we've got vendors that artists and, I mean, I'm talking all forums. Pencil and paper, painting, everything. Some podcasters, including the host with the most, and a little bit of everything. We've got an escape room set up in a film fest. A little bit of everything for everybody.
I was gonna say, I knew as soon as she said 10 seconds, you were gonna go like, "Oh my God, I'm gonna get this."
Yep.
Thankfully, it cuts off like when that's done, it cuts off the live stream, but we have 15 minutes that goes into the archive. So,
okay.
Thankfully, they don't disconnect you right away, but about quarter after they do.
I got you. Okay.
Monkey faces.
Well, then.
So,
so we've been talking, and we're going to get ready to meet up sometime soon. You're looking to get into the podcasting game. See, the podcasting game.
Yeah, that's the next thing. And besides, you know, first it was, why don't you write a book? Why don't you write a book? Why don't you write a book? And now the podcasting's blowing up, and everybody's like, why don't you talk about all your stuff on a podcast? And I have no clue. It's still somewhat foreign to me. I've always been on this end where either somebody calls me or they give me a number to call in and I talk. No big deal. You know, I'm not, what I am is non-tech as they come. This surprises a lot of people that don't know me, but everybody that does understands what goes into putting on this show. I still do all this on pen and paper, man. I don't have spreadsheets. I don't have this, that, and everything else. I've got a few more people helping me out with little pieces here and there. But even Sage and my daughter don't know everything I've got going on because I just that's how I operate, and I keep it all in a binder, and I'm very low tech. So the idea of setting up a show and talking, perfect. But you got to tell me how to save it and where to send it and how it gets done, and I don't know any of those things. So
honestly, the hardest part I came about with when I decided I wanted to get into radio wasn't so much learning how to run the switchboard. It was more being able to keep a conversation going, not being all fanboy when I wanted to be, and trying to keep some good questions coming. So I think, at least for me, I've never been, I can agree with you, I've never been a computer savvy person. I can run a few things on the laptop, and if it gets into some kind of Hotmail and a bunch of random little X's and there's a dash here and codes, and I have no idea what's going on.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that stuff, sorry about that. Didn't know I had the volume on something. That stuff is all foreign language to me. I mean, I don't get it at all. So if I had somebody where they just tell me to record something and they do the rest of the work for me, perfect. And that's why you ask if I wanted to host on, you know, be part of JIA or not. That sounds fine to me. I mean, I'm as easy as they come. You just tell me what to record. You tell me what my limits are, and it goes from there. And however that needs to work, I'm down with it.
Brian, it's internet, it's podcasting, there are no limits.
Well, I know on your show you like to keep it PC.
Well, not anymore. I said the F-word.
PG,
yeah. I quit doing that a long time ago because I found out, even though I told everybody, like, first sentence, hi, we are G-rated. Someone come on and go, oh, shit, that was a good fucking movie. And I'm like, well, thanks.
Yeah.
You just completely. So, I mean, it's the internet. There's no FCC. There's no rules. So why should I have mine? Because I cuss like a sailor anyways.
Yeah. Well, see, I was trying to be all nice, and when I slipped up earlier and said shit, I was worried about it because I realized I did it.
No, you're fine, B. But anything else you'd like to add before we let you go? I cannot wait. Now less than 2 weeks away. It's going to be such a blast. Fifth year in a row I've been able to be a part of this with you, and I thank you so very much for all the experiences and the laughs and the knowledge and the fun.
Not at all a problem, man. Yeah, you've been here almost the first one that nobody really recognizes or was a part of was a little 3-hour event in Rantoul that nobody knew about because I just didn't have any budget to let anybody know. So you've been with me ever since we've started trying to make the thing a big go out of it. So I appreciate having you around and being somebody that understands it and gets what I'm trying to do and doesn't view me as this ghoul that's trying to capitalize on all this stuff because you're interested as well, and that's my kind of people. And this is, if this gets played on the air, all I'm going to say is come out as macabre as it sounds, as dark as it sounds, I mean, it's in the title. This is a family of like-minded people. That's what everybody kind of comes for. We talk about con families. I like to think that I'm kind of an introvert around damn near anybody else except my people. And then I'm just a mile a minute like I am on their phone with you because that's because we get it. We love it. We love and respect each other, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Like I mentioned, I talked to Thibodeau earlier, and he just told me, he's like, I don't want to say nervous because I don't tend to get nervous, but he's like, there's something going on. I mean, I'm getting a little jumpy and excited, and I want to get up there. And he's like, I want to see some of these people you're going to come, and I want to hang out and talk with everybody. So he gets it, and I was like, that's what this show's all about, man, if nothing else. And he's like, I'm just coming up to hang out with people. I was like, sounds great. So
yeah, you know, this is the first year I was actually able to get off Sunday. So I am staying a night in Shambana and having some drinks and just going to try to relax with my fam.
Yeah, that works perfect, man. I did not bother about a hotel because we're only 15 minutes away max.
Yeah.
But, I imagine I'll be dragging ass a little bit just because I think I got to be there. I'm telling everybody I'm going to be there about 7 a.m. Saturday. The venue has a show Friday night, so I can't get in until Saturday morning to put up all the tables and stuff. And then and people start loading in. Post party's probably going to go till damn near 2 a.m. and then turn around and do it all again Sunday. So trying to fit in times to see people. I mean, Thibodeau talked about hanging out Friday night. James Leary's coming in Friday night. Yeah, I try not to make too many plans because I know how that goes, but I will definitely earmark some time for Thibodeau Friday whenever he gets into town. We're definitely going to hang out for a while.
Oh, absolutely. He was so down to earth, Brian. I enjoyed the interviews I did with him. Really was open about his experiences and willing to teach things and, you know, kill the common misconceptions about Waco that were spread through the media.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's what he just asked me. I mean, when we were on the phone, he was like, what are you expecting from me for the show? And I was like, man, I got no expectations. I'm just thrilled to have you here and talk about whatever you want to talk about. Because he'd originally talked when we started talking about doing some big, you know, almost like a PowerPoint hour long. Here's the videos, here's the pictures, let me show you what this is. And now he just talked to me. He's like, I think I'm mostly going to wing it. He's like, I got some pictures and stuff that I'll do on the laptop and put up on the screens. But for the most part, I'm just going to talk. And I was like, he's like, what do you want me to talk about? And I said, I think some people will need a refresher. Some people are young and they don't realize what all went down. And then I said, go wherever that leads you. I'm cool with it. So I think it's going to be just like a fireside conversation with Dave Thibodeau.
Absolutely. Well, Brian, thank you so much. And yes, the full interview will be heard once it goes into the archive in about 15 minutes. And I will drop you a copy of it to your Facebook and we will be in touch.
Sounds great, brother. And then, I'll start putting it in my rotation of things to share for the next week and a half.
Sounds good, brother. I will see you the 26th. And, you know, just try to enjoy yourself. Don't get too stressed out. We don't need a big playing ball of Brian around that weekend.
Right. I will do my best, man. And I appreciate it and look forward to seeing you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Brian. Have a great night.
Thank you. You do the same.
All right, bye-bye. All right, guys. Well, it was an interesting day for old Ian here. I got a pretty bad case of the frostbite on my right hand, and it's just killing me. It's basically the palm has got this nice little pocket of gooey fun on it, and a couple of my fingers have some spots. May go to the walk-in tomorrow. Hopefully, I was kind of waiting on the severity of it before I ran to the hospital. I'm not one of those run-to-the-doctors kind of people. So I'm going to try to wait it out while I can, but it is giving me a lot of pain, and I'm not really being able to use it much. So thankfully, it didn't affect the left hand since that's my dominant one, and I can't do much else with the right one. So I guess if it had to affect anybody, or any part, I guess I should say, I'm glad it wasn't the left. Well, Brian, 21 hours ago on Facebook, said out of the blue just secured yet another celebrity guest. So we will be, I guess I'll have to let you guys know once that announcement is made exactly who that fresh face name is going to be. But like I mentioned, check out DHHCon.com for all the guest information, vendors, podcasts, ticket information, how to get there, everything else is at DHHCon.com. And, of course, you can find Brian Ward on Facebook. He's also got Brian's Dark History and Pop Culture page and, of course, the Dark History and HorrorCon Facebook as well if you're into the scary, the spooky, the dark, and the creepy. So we will leave you at that. No show scheduled at the moment coming up, but I do have a few more
last night. October 19th, we'll welcome actor James Stokes. I'm going to have to look up his IMDb because I'm kind of flatlining on this man's career. And I don't like to try to fly by the seat of my pants with saying stuff like that, because that's when you throw some film or TV role in this guy's never even heard of. So I don't want to have to do that. Of course, he was on an episode of Stranger Things, and that's one of Netflix's big series, and I heard a lot of great things about that. He's also got some stuff in pre- and post-production, some other films and appearances include The Silent Natural, Mark of a Killer, Raiden Valkyrie, Snapped, Soldier's Joy, The Switch. Yeah, so it's going to be nice talking with James. He seemed really enthused to talk with me, and I am in turn enthused to talk with him. I think it's going to be an awesome chat. So stay tuned to facebook.com/theonlyhostwiththemost. And, of course, check out JIANetwork.com. You can find us on Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, Podbean, Radio Public, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and about 15 platforms altogether. So be sure and check out JIA Network, Cloverleaf Radio, Night Moves Radio, Three Podcasters in the Microphone, The Hollywood Connection, Soul Stories, and, of course, Brian Ward's got an upcoming podcast we're going to be welcoming as well. So you never know who's coming. You never know what's going on. It's a true variety show, and I look forward to seeing you guys next time. So, as always, thank you, everybody, for listening. Have yourselves a great day.